Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Maple glazed root vegetables with orange and thyme. Braised short ribs with sun-dried tomatoes. Honey poached apricots. This is a meal without surprises. No hidden ingredients, all fresh and nutritional. So, what's the catch? Joining us to talk about old-fashioned food is the creator of NourishedKitchen.com and the author of a new cookbook, The Nourished Kitchen, Farm-to-Table Recipes for the Traditional Foods Lifestyle. She joins me by phone from Crested Butte, Colorado. Jennifer McGruther, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you so much for having me, Ann.
First, tell us what the traditional foods lifestyle is, because I'm afraid that's the catch.
Right. Foods is a growing movement within the country that emphasizes the importance of sustainable agriculture as it relates to how rich foods are in nourishment, as well as traditional methods of preparing foods. Essentially, and in its essence, the traditional foods movement is the foods of your great-great-grandmother. They are whole, unprocessed, prepared at home, and they are farmed with intention, prepared with intention, and served with intention as well.
Right. Farmed with intention, prepared with intention. It's all connected.
Absolutely.
Tell us why. What's the connection and why we need to necessarily know where the tomato came from?
Well, from my perspective, I think that when we look at how we purchase our foods, we can often see, you know, just the bottom line of the grocery store. And that's only one perspective. But rather, when we examine where the foods come from, how well they support our local community, how well our purchases can really support an individual family who may be adhering to farming techniques that actually support soil health or support the local environment. That's one perspective. Also, our foods and our choices that we make affect not only ourselves, but they also affect farm workers. So when we consider whether or not we're going to choose foods that are raised with conventional chemical inputs versus those that are raised without them, we can look at the effects that those might have on other people. So our food choices are not just about ourselves, they're about other people. And further, when we get into the concept of animal foods, those you know, steaks and meat, butter and cheese, fish and those kinds of foods, animal foods that are raised a certain way, that is, on fresh pasture, actually offer more complete and better nourishment than those that are raised through industrial means.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Jennifer McGruther. She's the creator of NourishedKitchen.com, and she's the author of a new cookbook, The Nourished Kitchen, Farm-to-Table Recipes for the Traditional Foods Lifestyle. If you have a question or comment, want to talk about traditional foods and how you incorporate them into your life, we would love to hear from you. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, Jennifer, you work really hard at the NourishedKitchen.com website. What made you want to do a cookbook, something so conventional as a cookbook?
You know, my readers ask me for it. There's one thing to look online and print out recipes or to read information on a blog, for instance, and there's another thing completely to hold something in your hands, to have something tangible that you can bring into the kitchen, that you can dog-ear, that you can read through at your bedside table. It provides a tangibility to my work. And also, so many people, when they come to NourishedKitchen.com through search engines or through social media, they hit on one page. And one page only can tell part of the story, one recipe or one tutorial. Whereas in the full book, it covers not only individual recipes, of course, but philosophy, and it brings a fuller, holistic perspective to the traditional foods movement that I think can be very valuable to readers.
Not everybody thinks that they have the time to do this. Is this a sort of what approach do you recommend? An incremental approach? Do what you can approach? How do you feel about that?
Absolutely. I think that every small step you make in the right direction is a positive step. And it can be very easy to stumble across a movement like the traditional foods movement, which is, you know, a very passionate and compassionate movement, and then feel compelled to engage in every practice. You might start fermenting foods and growing your own. And I encourage newcomers to not allow themselves to become overwhelmed. I think it's really important to start slowly, to determine one small change that you can bring into your life, make that work, whether that's shopping at the farmer's market regularly, whether that's making your own broth or stock, or learning to make yogurt for the first time. Take one step, make it work for your family, make it work for your time and your schedule, and once that's established, that'll give you an opportunity to move forward with new things in a successful way.
You're a big fan of the research of health pioneer Weston Price. He's a dentist from Cleveland. He died in 1948. We have a clip of him talking about modern versus what he called primitive or traditional diet. Let's listen.
The most universal disease in the world is the decay of the teeth. And unfortunately, we have not known the cause until we've gone to the primitive people to find how they prevent tooth decay. Our difficulty is that we are adding too much white flour and sugar and do not get enough of the foods that carry the minerals and vitamins.
It's interesting. My dentist never brings up my diet. Tell us about Weston Price and how he inspired you.
Weston Price was a dentist, you know, living in the early part of the 20th century. And what he discovered in his practice was that as his practice grew and as he aged, many children were coming into his practice with severe dental deformities, with cavities before they were even two. On their milk teeth, they had cavities. And he tried to determine exactly what had changed from his childhood when people were healthy, they had good quality teeth, they didn't need braces or orthodontics, to the modern children or the children of his contemporaries, which were suffering from not only dental diseases, but disease in general. And so what he did is he traveled the world, and he went to isolated pockets and isolated populations all across the world, North America, the South Pacific, Australia, the Outer Hebrides, the isolated pockets of the Alps, Africa, and he found one consistent thing. Those people who adhered to their traditional diets, now traditional diets meaning they were foods like white sugar and white flour that you heard him speak about, were absent from their diets. Mm-hmm. And so as a result of adhering to traditional diets, they were eating more mineral-rich diets and diets that were richer in fat-soluble vitamins like vitamin A, vitamin D, vitamin E, and vitamin K2. And as a result of these nutrient-dense traditional diets in which modern processed foods were absent, they exhibited exemplary health. Even without modern health care or modern dentistry, cavities were virtually non-existent in this population, and they exhibited overall health and well-being well into their 90s, which was not seen in the populations he studied that had been exposed to more modern processed foods. And so that was his studies, and he was, you know, one of the few people who were really able to investigate what traditional diets looked like at that time, as now. Now we look at diets all across the world, and they're relatively modernized.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of my interest in Dr. Price, I happened to stumble upon his work and his landmark book, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration. I read it, and I found it to be fascinating, if a little bit dry.
Mm-hmm.
And then his work, of course, is championed by the not-for-profit organization, the Weston A. Price Foundation, which is an educational initiative that examines the role of traditional diets and fat-soluble vitamins in modern health.
You don't call for a ban on sugar per se. You made an interesting remark in your book, though, and I have to paraphrase it because I don't have it with me, but it's something about how sugar is a strong ingredient, that
yes,
it's powerful.
Yes, and, you know, sugar is like salt, for example. A little bit can do wonders for an individual dish. It can be, it can bring out flavors. It can heighten that dish. But having too much of it not only overwhelms the food, it overwhelms your taste buds, and it's not necessarily good for us, but a little bit is fine. And what we find when we look at traditional diets all across the world, one of the characteristics of them is the inclusion of sweet celebratory foods. They would indeed sweeten their foods for celebratory occasions. The difference is that traditional diets often used unrefined sweeteners as opposed to refined white sugar.
Mm-hmm.
So unrefined sweeteners like raw honey, for example, that you might pick up at the farmer's market, or jaggery, which is a traditional sugar out of India. It's simply raw cane juice that has been paddled and cooked until it hardens. All of these unrefined sweeteners, they retain B vitamins. They retain an array of minerals. So they provide nourishment in addition to sweetness. And because they are sugars and they are concentrated and sweet, it's best to use them with a mindful hand, not only for your outcome of your dish, but for your health as well.
We are largely a nation of sugar addicts now.
It concerns me when I see the number of sweetened foods that we've become accustomed to. In the morning, you might have a cup of coffee, for example, and you add a little bit of sugar, a little bit of honey to it, and that little bit isn't very much on its own. But then you have a cup of yogurt with it, and of course, you don't have plain yogurt. You have a fruit-based yogurt, which is sweetened with sugar or high fructose corn syrup. And then at lunch, you might do yourself a favor and say, for example, have a salad, only that, you know, your salad dressing has been sweetened. And so we're eating sweet foods all day long. And now what we find is that we're eating considerable amounts of more sugar than we did, say, at the turn of the century or the turn of the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
or, for example, in the 18th century, where somebody, an average person might consume less than 10 pounds of added sweeteners a year, and we're finding that we're consuming considerably more than that now.
My guest is Jennifer McGruther. She is the creator of NourishedKitchen.com and the author of a new cookbook. It's called The Nourished Kitchen, Farm-to-Table Recipes for the Traditional Foods Lifestyle. We'll get to some of those recipes, talk more about the traditional foods lifestyle. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking today about a back-to-basics cooking style that connects how food is raised with how it's prepared and how it nourishes us. It's a pre-Pop-Tart approach, and it's gaining popularity as people start to worry about the health risks of processed convenience foods. My guest is Jennifer McGruther. She's the creator of NourishedKitchen.com and the author of a new cookbook called The Nourished Kitchen, Farm-to-Table Recipes for the Traditional Foods Lifestyle. If you have a question or comment for Jennifer, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Jennifer, you mentioned earlier about fermentation, a trend that's popped up in the last few years. What is it about fermented foods, and is it a big deal to do it yourself?
Fermented foods are certainly one of the top food trends for the last few years, and it comes from a place of practicality. For example, fermented foods were a way to preserve the harvest prior to refrigeration or to canning. And what we find is traditional foods from all across the world typically include at least some fermented dishes, whether that is yogurt out of the Caucasus or yogurt out of Scandinavia, whether that's kimchi in Korea or choucroute in France. All traditional societies hold a very special place for fermented foods. Fermented foods are essentially foods that are allowed to sit out under very closely monitored conditions. And these conditions allow beneficial bacteria to populate that food. Essentially, the beneficial bacteria will consume the carbohydrates in the food and convert them to various acids, like lactic acid, for example. During this process of fermentation, what happens is in addition to reducing the carbohydrate load of these foods, they also infuse the foods with a wide array of B vitamins, particularly folate, which is a vitamin that is critical for women of reproductive age for its effect to help to prevent neural tube defects in newborn babies. So we find that traditional foods all across the world include fermented foods, and that these foods not only have the added benefit of being enzyme-rich and rich in beneficial bacteria, you know, just like the yogurt you might find at the grocery store, but also they are richer in vitamins than they were when they were simply, you know, raw or cooked fresh. And of course, fermentation is something that sounds a lot scarier than it is when it comes to food preparation, especially since we live in a culture that tends to avoid bacteria. We have antibacterial soap, antibacterial sprays and wipes, and so it's a bit of an opportunity to expand your mind when you work with fermented foods, because you are intentionally growing bacteria in them. Essentially, at its simplest, fermented foods are foods that are, you know, to prepare fermented foods, you simply need some fresh vegetables, you need salt, and you need thyme. And by thyme, I mean T-I-M-E. You need the thyme for those beneficial bacteria to do their work. So when we prepare pickled beets in the traditional way, what we do is we shred beets very, very finely. We salt them, and as we salt them, we pack them into a fermentation crock or a jar until they release their juice. That juice will combine with the salt, and it will begin to cover those beets. And what that does is that creates an ideal condition for for beneficial bacteria to proliferate. And interestingly, the conditions that allow beneficial bacteria to proliferate also prevent the proliferation of potentially pathogenic bacteria. So everybody's concerned about foodborne illness, and that's not a strong risk with fermented foods. So as long as those foods remain submerged under brine, this is in an anaerobic environment, essentially, and you can buy, you know, specialized crocks for that. As long as they remain submerged, those beneficial bacteria will grow, and those potentially harmful microbes that are responsible for food rotting will not grow. So you'll have fermented food instead, and these fermented foods are incredibly rich in beneficial bacteria, and they really help to support digestive wellness as well as immunity.
But do they taste good?
Oh, my goodness. I guess that's all a matter of personal perspective, but yes. Yes, I do. Think of a wonderful crunchy pickle, like a garlic dill pickle on a hot summer day next to your sandwich or your hot dog. And it's just absolutely wonderful. It's crisp, it's sour, it's infused with garlic and dill and spice. It's a wonderful food. So a lot of our pickled foods are traditionally made not with vinegar, but rather through fermentation.
So I was going to ask you about the vinegar part of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what you mean by fermentation. It doesn't involve vinegar.
No. Vinegar has already been fermented. So whether that's red wine that has been turned into red wine vinegar, you know, using a mother of vinegar, or apple cider being turned into cider vinegar, that's an already fermented food. When we're referring to fermented foods in Nourish Kitchen, the Nourish Kitchen, or typically on nourishkitchen.com, we're referring to bacterial ferments or lacto-fermentation. That's fermented foods that encourage the growth of lactobacillus bacteria. Those are beneficial bacteria, the same kind that you find in milk kefir at the store or in yogurt. And so even vegetables can be rich in that. And when you prepare fermented foods at home, What you want is you want those beneficial bacteria to convert the carbohydrates in the vegetables into acids, and those acids then preserve the food. If you are using vinegar, you're not really fermenting your foods because they will be preserved through the acid of vinegar, and those carbohydrates don't have a chance to be converted into the acids, which occurs in true fermentation.
Now, you make it sound pretty easy.
It is easy. I'm not going to discount that for many people who are new to cooking, especially new to traditional foods, there seems to be a mental hurdle that occurs. But remember, the foods of our great-great-grandparents aren't foods that are terribly complicated. They are very, very simple foods. You know, we look at our modern lives and we have, you know, we work full time and we take the kids to soccer practice, and it can often feel like we're being pulled in all directions at once. And so cooking might just be one more step that you just can't make it through the evening. Instead, traditional foods are very, very simple foods, and our predecessors didn't have hours and hours and hours to spend in the kitchen either. They had children to raise. They had farms to tend. They had animals to tend. And so their time was occupied as well. And so fermented foods, for example, it seems complicated on the outset to say, turn a beautiful lemon into a preserved lemon, you know, the Moroccan preserved lemons,
mm-hmm.
Or to turn milk into something like yogurt or Greek yogurt. But the reality is most of these fermented foods are very, very simple. They require no more time than it would take you to stir starter culture into milk, stir something into milk, and let it sit out. So we're talking the average time to make yogurt, which is a fermented milk product, is about 5 minutes of your active time and then about 8 to 12 hours to let it sit. Pretty easy.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Jennifer McGruther. She's the author of a new cookbook. It's called The Nourished Kitchen, Farm-to-Table Recipes for the Traditional Foods Lifestyle. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There is a debate in the nutrition science world about whether meat and animal fats are bad for us. You embrace them. Tell us how you do that and why you think they're okay.
Absolutely. It certainly is controversial. I mean, we've heard for the last 30 years that saturated fats are linked to heart disease. What we find in traditional societies and among those who adhere to traditional foods is that meat and animal fat in particular actually support systemic wellness. Now, that's not to say that plant foods don't have a place in traditional diets. In fact, I would call a traditional foods diet a plant-based diet, though it is certainly not a vegetarian diet and most certainly not a vegan diet.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, it's about the inclusion of animal foods that support our health. And for that reason, traditional foods enthusiasts highly recommend and emphasize the importance of how animals are raised. For example, when a dairy cow is raised on fresh pasture, that is, they derive their, when they subsist on their species-appropriate diet of fresh grass, their milk is actually extraordinarily rich in vitamin A. It is also rich in vitamin E, as well as the antioxidant beta-carotene, which then converts to vitamin A. It's also a good source of the fat conjugated linoleic acid, and research into conjugated linoleic acid indicates that it helps to support metabolic health, as well as it offers anti-carcinogenic properties as well. And it's been really interesting. A few years ago, there was a study of 17,000 Swedish men. And what they found was that those men who had the highest consumption of fruits and vegetables had the lowest rate of cardiovascular disease, which is no surprise. But what they found in addition to that was only the case for those men who also ate full-fat dairy, because fats, particularly animal fats, really support systemic health when they're eaten with mindfulness and when they come from the appropriate sources, which means they are nutrient-dense fat that is rich in vitamins. Also, for example, pasture-raised eggs are, as opposed to eggs from battery cage hens, pasture raised means that the hens are allowed free access to the outdoors. So they not only get to run around in the fresh grass, but they get to eat grubs and bugs and things like that. What we find is that they are about, they have more omega-3 fatty acids than those of hens raised in confinement. They are also richer in vitamin A. They have two-thirds more vitamin A than those raised in confinement and three times more vitamin E. So when animals are raised properly and in healthful conditions, their meat, milk, and eggs are richer in nourishment, and so they can support our health in unique ways. Also, we need animal fats, and we need fat in general. Fat in general helps to support our systemic health by enabling your body to better absorb the vitamins that your fruits and vegetables contain. So fruits and vegetables contain a lot of antioxidants. They contain a lot of vitamins, like, you know, vitamin K1, for example. All of these vitamins are typically better absorbed and best absorbed when they come when they're eaten in conjunction with fat, whether that fat is olive oil or, for example, butter.
You tout the benefits of raw dairy. What is raw dairy?
Raw dairy is milk that is fresh from the cow. It's and it has not been subject to pasteurization or homogenization. And raw dairy is rich in beneficial bacteria, and it is rich in food enzymes. And so when we examine traditional diets of dairying people, that is people who for whom dairy products and raising dairy cows was a significant source of their foods, they were always consuming their dairy products raw, whether that was fermented as yogurt, for example, raw milk yogurt or milk kefir, whether that was raw milk cheese, or whether they were drinking the pure raw milk.
You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Now, raw dairy isn't legal in all states, right?
No, it's certainly not. Many states make the acquisition of raw milk and raw dairy very difficult to come by or completely illegal. In many states, it's not available for retail sale. There's a few states where it is available for retail sale, like California, for example. Other states, like Colorado, offer what's called herd share opportunities. And so, for example, you would have the opportunity to purchase part of a herd, a dairy herd. Hmm. And when you purchase part of a dairy herd, you are, as a part owner, you are entitled to whatever that herd produces. In the case of dairy cows, it's raw milk. And so that's one way for many people to consume or to acquire raw milk if they like. And for people who live in areas where raw milk is not easily accessed, I think it's really important to note, or who do not wish to consume raw milk, I think it's important to note that the real key with dairy products is not necessarily that they be raw, although from my perspective, that's ideal. The real key is that they come from grass-fed cows, because when the cows are fed on fresh pasture, they're fed on grass, the milk they produce is very rich in vitamins, it's rich in antioxidants, and it has an optimal level of healthy fats like omega-3s, as well as conjugated linoleic acid and things like that. So if you cannot find or do not wish to acquire raw milk, I would recommend that you consider purchasing low-temperature pasteurized milk from grass-fed cows, whether that's from a local dairy or from a national supplier like Kelowna Natural.
You, how do you feel about gluten? That's another, I hate to use the word trendy because people take it very seriously and it sounds, I don't want to, you know, cast dispersion at all, but what about the gluten, anti-gluten movement?
Well, you know, I think that many, many, many people have found an extraordinary amount of healing by adhering to gluten-free diets. And I think, you know, in recent news, there's been discussion that non-celiac gluten sensitivity may just be in, you know, readers' heads or people's heads. And I find that to be terribly dismissive of people's experiences. And I don't feel that is effective or productive in a conversation that promotes people's health. Gluten can affect many people in many, many different ways. And it's not just celiacs that may experience issues with gluten. That said, I don't think that a gluten-free diet is the panacea that the health food movement seems to believe it is. I see people hopping on a gluten-free diet simply because that's the thing to do right now. And I don't believe that that may be the most effective choice. And I don't know that that comes from a place of true intention or attention to wellness. So in traditional diets all across the world, some diets were naturally gluten-free. So, for example, in the South Pacific, their traditional diet typically includes lots of coconut, lots of fish, lots of fresh tropical fruits, and they weren't, you know, they weren't a farming community that farmed, you know, wheat or barley or oats, because that simply wasn't grown in the South Pacific. However, in other areas of the world, for example, in the isolated pockets of the Swiss mountains that Dr. Price studied that we discussed earlier, gluten-containing grains, they provided significant nourishment in terms of sourdough rye bread. Or oats, for example, is another grain that some people who avoid gluten avoid oats. And they that features prominently in the traditional diets of both Scotland and Ireland. So I don't necessarily think that gluten is the culprit it's made out to be. I think some people may need to avoid it. Some may need to avoid it for their lifetime, for example, celiac patients. Other people may need to avoid it for as a temporary solution as they begin to approach whole foods. I think many of the people who are on gluten-free diets without maybe who've chosen a gluten-free diet without a doctor's recommendation may see the advantage simply because they are starting to avoid more processed foods. So in terms of the Nourish Kitchen, we include many, many gluten-free recipes simply because you're not likely to put bread or grains in a salad or in a custard. But we also feature, I also feature a lot of whole grain sourdough breads. And I think that they are wonderful and lovely.
My guest is Jennifer McGruther. She's the author of a new cookbook. It's called The Nourished Kitchen, Farm-to-Table Recipes for the Traditional Foods Lifestyle. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. My guest is Jennifer McGruther. We're talking about the traditional foods lifestyle, and she's the author of a new cookbook. It's called The Nourished Kitchen, Farm-to-Table Recipes for the Traditional Foods Lifestyle. If you have a question or comment for Jennifer McGruther, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. On your website, you list what to stock in a traditional foods pantry. Let's talk about that. Among other things, you have a lot of different kinds of beans, for example, marrow beans and anasazi beans. How did you come up with this list?
Part of it is just an example of what I keep in my pantry. As a person who absolutely loves food, I keep a wide variety of pulses, of beans, of lentils, of whole grains, and assorted other foods. The traditional foods pantry is just a simple look at what I have in my kitchen, and that helps readers to understand, get a full perspective of what traditional foods looks like for somebody else so that they can take what they need and apply it. But for most people, I recommend stocking a wide variety of wholesome fats. For example, I recommend stocking good grass-fed butter. I recommend stocking good olive oil. You can find some great olive oils, straight from the producers out in California. You can also pick up some wonderful foods like grass-fed ghee. Ghee is a traditional fat from India. It's a traditional clarified butter, so it's shelf-stable at room temperature. I also stock a lot of beans and pulses because they make for easy, simple, and affordable meals. So, for example, one of my favorite beans, I think you mentioned it, was marrow beans. Marrow beans are an heirloom bean, and they have a flavor once cooked that is slightly reminiscent of bacon. And, you know, bacon and beans, they go so wonderfully together.
Everything's better.
It does. So that's a great example of something that I use quite frequently. I also use a lot of flours. You know, I like einkorn flour. Einkorn is an heirloom wheat, and I think it has a wonderful flavor. It's also very rich in antioxidants and beta carotene. So these are foods that I recommend stocking. Dried fruit is another wonderful thing that people can stock in their kitchens, as well as nuts. Those make, not only can they enhance the dishes you make, so, you know, throw a handful of pine nuts into a risotto, but they're also great snacks. You know, you can take some almonds and some dried apricots, pack them into a little baggie for yourself, and then you have an easy, healthy snack to take with you on the road.
You're a mom with young kids. How do they take to the traditional foods lifestyle, and what advice do you have for parents with picky eaters?
Oh, yes. My son has always been raised on traditional foods, so he's never known anything else. And that's not to say that he doesn't like macaroni and cheese and chicken fingers. My goodness, what kid doesn't? But he tends to have a very open palate. And so having been raised on wholesome whole foods from the very beginning has meant that he is very open-minded. For people who are newcomers to the movement and who may be beginning to incorporate whole foods into their family's diets in a new way, one of the things that I recommend doing is make better versions of the foods your children already love. So, for example, if your children absolutely love chicken fingers, for example, one thing that you can do is you can make them from scratch at home using wholesome ingredients. You can use free-range, organic, or pasture-raised chicken breast. You can season them with unrefined sea salt, and you can fry them in or sauté them in a really wholesome fat like the grass-fed ghee. And so one of the best things you can do as you approach foods for picky eaters or for newcomers to traditional foods is just make the foods you already like a little bit better with better ingredients. And then slowly, bit by bit, you might introduce a wonderful new vegetable to the family. You might introduce, if your family's accustomed to beef, you might introduce lamb to them once they're more accustomed to it.
David in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hi. I always like to hear more about healthy diets. One thing I heard was that there's a lot of contributing factors to osteoporosis. One of them was heavy animal protein ingestion, which creates higher acid levels in the blood, and the body has to neutralize the acid levels and bring the blood back to a more neutral level by taking calcium from the bones.
Right. We hear a lot, especially among enthusiasts of plant-based vegan and vegetarian diets, that dairy is acidic and leaches calcium from the bones. What I find is that is inaccurate, and part of the issues with osteoporosis is lack of vitamin K2. In fact, research into vitamin K2, incidentally, for readers or for listeners out there, vitamin K2 is found almost exclusively in animal foods. It's in grass-fed butter. It's in the fat of lamb and things like that. You can also find it in a plant-based source in fermented soybeans or natto. Vitamin K2 really helps to take calcium and put it where it needs to be in the body. It also helps to support cardiovascular health. So the very thing that when we're looking only at calcium in relationship to osteoporosis, or if we're only looking at dairy products alone in the relationship to osteoporosis, we're not looking at whole diets, diets that are rich in vitamins and minerals, diets that are rich in vitamin K2 that help to work synergistically with nutrients like vitamin D and calcium to put our minerals where they deserve to be in bones. And when you look at traditional diets, those are diets that did include meat and butter and animal fat, as well as animal protein, you find that the women who adhere to their traditional diets, absent of white flour and white sugar and refined vegetable oils, actually exhibited remarkable bone health well into their 90s.
Thank you, David, for that call. What do you mean by refined vegetable oils again?
Refined vegetable oils are cooking fats that have been, they come from vegetable seeds, and they have been refined through hexane extraction, through all sorts of chemical processes that can degrade the oil with time, as well as can produce oils that are very, very high in polyunsaturated fatty acids. Polyunsaturated fatty acids include omega-6 fatty acids as well as omega-3 fatty acids, and they are best suited to very, very, very light cooking or to consuming raw. When we cook with fats, we should be cooking with monounsaturated fats. That's fat found in avocados, olive oil, pasteurized lard, as well as saturated fats, which are found in butter, ghee, as well as beef and lamb. And so refined vegetable oils have been subject to a lot of industrial processes that can really change how our bodies react to that oil. They are processed at very, very high temperatures, which damages their fragile polyunsaturated fats. Refined vegetable oils that you find in the store go under the name of vegetable oil, for example, corn oil, soybean oil, canola oil. These are all more modern oils and fats that we've only really begun using in the last 50 to 75 years, as opposed to traditional fats, which include pasteurized lard, butter, ghee, clarified butter, tallow, olive oil, as well as some nut oils.
Deb in Sunbury, you're on the air. Hi, Deb.
Hi. If I can go back to the fermentation issue again, you mentioned using salt for that, and I wondered if there's any worry about using too much salt.
Too much salt in a fermented food will simply prolong the fermentation period. If you're talking about the consumption of salt as it relates to health, what we find is that low salt diets really only benefit a very, 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 very small portion of the population. And most of us benefit from consuming salt as needed and as our taste buds demand throughout our diet. What I recommend is using whole, unrefined sea salt. Now, this table salt that you find on your dinner table or at restaurants or at the grocery store is largely refined. It has agents in it that make it free-flowing, and its trace minerals are largely absent. When you choose whole, unrefined sea salt, for example, Redmond Real Salt, Celtic Gray Salt, these are natural salts that contain not only sodium chloride, which makes our food salty, but they also contain a wide array of minerals that support systemic wellness, and that is the way salt is intended to be consumed. So you have to draw the line between, is this a natural food or is this a refined food? For people who are still concerned about salt in their diet, you can still prepare your fermented foods, and you can simply soak them in clean water, which will reduce the saltiness of the food.
An email from a listener going back to the raw dairy. By the way, Deb, thanks for that call. Going back to the raw dairy issue, they asked, did Ms. McGruther just advocate for raw dairy products? Isn't this very dangerous because of outbreaks of E. coli, listeria, and salmonella?
This is a very good question, and I'm really, really thankful to your listener who brought that up. Certainly, the consumption, especially the advocation for raw dairy products, is controversial. And in my experience, what I find and what research into raw dairy products also determines is that when dairy products come from healthy animals, those dairy products are also healthy. So, for example, we're not discussing consuming raw dairy from industrially raised cattle that are, you know, subject to confined operations where they're eating lots of grain, which can change the acid composition of their stomach and make it more prone to contamination by certain types of E. coli. What we're talking about is the dairy that comes from animals that are raised on fresh pasture. They are healthy animals, and so they are less likely to become sick. As they are healthy animals, the milk that they produce is also healthy. That's not to say that there isn't a risk in consuming raw dairy. There certainly is, as there is a risk to consuming, you know, spinach, for example, peanut butter, or any of the number of foods, ground beef, that have been subject to nationwide recalls. The risk for raw dairy is one that you'll have to weigh on a personal level. And if you find that you are concerned about salmonella or E. coli or listeria in your raw milk, I would recommend that you consider purchasing low-temperature pasteurized grass-fed milk.
And this also goes along with your idea about knowing where the food comes from.
Absolutely. You know, my family has consumed raw milk, you know, for the last 8 years, I think. And so it's not, I think it's a mistake to say that there is no risk. And there are some raw milk advocates who do minimize the risk of raw dairy. But there is a risk in every food we consume.
You are an advocate for lard.
Yeah,
you wrote
yes.
quite a love letter to lard in the book.
Yes. Lard, you know, is perhaps the most reviled animal fat in a modern culinary sense, and it's such a shame. We're ready to re-embrace butter, and coconut oil is enjoying a heyday right now, and coconut oil is pure saturated fat with very, very little antioxidant or vitamins in it, but we're in love with it right now. It's in all of our health foods recipes, and people absolutely love it, but we still hate lard, and it's so unfortunate. Lard is not only does lard offer brilliant culinary attributes to the table and to various dishes, it's great for making pastries, for biscuits, it's great for sautéing vegetables or for help in braising meats. Lard is also very rich in monounsaturated fat. In fact, about 45% of the fat content of lard, so the dominant fat in lard, is monounsaturated. For those who may be unfamiliar with it, monounsaturated fats are also the same fats that we find in avocados, which are lauded for their health benefits. It's the same fat that we find dominantly in olive oil, which is also considered to be a heart-healthy fat. It's a shame that we have come down on lard when it is actually a remarkably healthy fat. Now, when we look at lard, I recommend that you purchase lard from animals that have been raised on fresh pasture. When they are raised on fresh pasture, they are able to manufacture vitamin D in their skin. So pigs, like humans, manufacture vitamin D in their skin and in their fat when they are subject to sunlight. So that fat that we then render into lard is one of the richest food sources for vitamin D that we have available to us, second only to cod liver oil. Also, one thing to consider is that a few years ago, a study came out and found that over 70% of U.S. children are suffering from insufficient or deficient levels of vitamin D. So that's not only related to not getting outside enough, but also lacking lard in our food sources, or lacking vitamin D in our food sources.
Jennifer McGruther, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jennifer McGruther, she's the creator of NourishedKitchen.com. She's also the author of a new cookbook. It's called The Nourished Kitchen, Farm-to-Table Recipes for the Traditional Foods Lifestyle. Thanks to the All-Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants from Olivia Rojas, Justin English, Emmy Beach, Julia Hyder, and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DiCenzo is a composer of our theme music, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.